All right, there we go. Wednesday morning Bible study, Gospel of John. Last time we met, we finished up chapter 7. I should say nearly. There's one verse left, which we'll address today and then go on into chapter 8. Maybe get probably not quite halfway through. So chapter 7, you'll remember all the way back at the beginning, Jesus is going to the Feast of Booths. John is very chronological, very linear. His brothers say to him, let's go to the Feast of Booths. He says, no, you go ahead. And then secretly he goes down, ends up at the Feast of Booths, is kind of there incognito. And then in the middle of the feast, he starts to teach. Well, nothing like just proclaiming yourself that there you are, right? He makes it known. And of course, the Jews are confronting him. How do you have authority to teach? And so he has to defend himself a little bit. He's speaking on God's authority, and he references the law there. And, of course, they have problems with that. So the conflict that has started previous to this chapter is continuing, and it's growing. And some people were wondering, who is it you say is killing you? And others of the crowds recognized that some of the Jews wanted to kill him. So already that is beginning. The Jews sent officers, probably temple guard, to go and arrest Jesus. And Jesus talks to them a little bit, and they come back, and Jews are wondering, where is he? Right here. Let's see. The officers then came to the chief priests. Why did you not bring him? You were supposed to arrest him. Why didn't you bring him? And they say, no one ever spoke like this man. Remember this? Have you been befuddled by him as well? Have you been deceived? None of us have been deceived. You guys are too simple. You're simpletons, they're basically saying. Have you been deceived? And then Nicodemus, very briefly, kind of works up the courage to, you know, in a slight way, to try and defend Jesus. You can't judge him without having first heard him, without learning about what he's teaching and saying. And then they attack Nicodemus. Are you from Galilee? Search and see that no prophet arises from Galilee. That's an insult. You're some backward, podunk person from Galilee. That nobody comes from Galilee. So they attack Nicodemus now. So that's an insult. How would you insult somebody like that today? Somebody last night said, you would say they're from Baroda. Oh. I don't know if that's true, but somebody last night said it. Wow. I don't know.
Believe me, that's what they used to do all the time in Lakeshore. Pick on the people.
Baroda people? Yeah.
And that was me.
And that was you.
Well, they didn't pick on me, but...
Is it...
smart remarks about farmers from Baroda.
Really?
Yeah.
Does it still happen, or maybe a little bit, or not so much, or... Not so much anymore?
I'm not sure.
All right.
I don't know. I don't have any kids over there anymore.
I can tell you I haven't heard it. But,
St. Joe, we used to say the farmers from Lakeshore.
Yeah. Oh, the farmers from Lakeshore. So it was all of Lakeshore, not just Baroda. So Stevensville included. Yeah, all right. Now, you'll remember part of this, because this will come up again in a little bit here. Jesus says as part of his teaching here at the... Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles, he says, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink, and out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. Remember I mentioned last class that part of the theme and part of the ritual of the Feast of Booths involves water. And it was partly to remember that God gave water to the Israelites when they were wandering in the wilderness, when they were in their booths, in their tents, wandering the wilderness. God provided them water. So if you think about the three great feasts, they all pertain to what they would perceive as three of the greatest signs or miracles of God saving them in the wilderness. The Passover, salvation from slavery in Egypt, getting them out of Egypt. Then the Feast of Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks, that's all about God providing them manna to eat, bread. Jesus has already said, I am the bread of life. And then the Feast of Booths had a primary theme of remembering that God provided them water. And he did that a few times through Moses, right? One time he told Moses to strike the rock, the next time he told Moses to speak to the rock, but Moses struck it, so then there was that issue, but nevertheless they got water. All right. Then we have this strange section here that starts with one verse in chapter 7. Why one verse in chapter 7? I don't know. And then it goes on to chapter 8 for 11 verses. And it says here in the ESV, the earliest manuscripts do not include 753 through 811. Now, all of your translations probably say that. Does anybody happen to have King James? I think King James would even say that. So, the question is this real or authentic? Because in some places it's included in other locations. It's in other spots in John, or it occurs in Luke in some of the manuscripts. So is this, what's the status of this particular event? Okay, so verse 53 here it says, they went each to his own house. And then I'm going to go forward to chapter 8 because that's where most of it is. Chapter 8. And then it starts out, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning he came again to the temple. All the people came to him and he sat down and taught them. So before we go through this event, let me talk a little bit about the status of this. Many scholars do not consider this to be written by the Apostle John. It's not part of the Gospel of John. And after reading Dr. Weinrich's commentary and some of his analysis of this, I think he's convinced me. I would agree with that as well. I'm not sure what Pastor Q's status is. But the issue is, that speaks the loudest on this, is that this event here in the beginning of chapter 8 does not exist in any of the earliest manuscripts of the New Testament until the 4th century. Okay? So we being scholars, museums and such, there's somewhere around 8 or 10 different manuscripts, sheepskins, parchments, scrolls, that were all copied and written between the 1st and the 3rd century of the New Testament. They're in museums and places. None of those copies, up until the 4th century, include this at all. After the 4th century, it is included, but in a couple of different locations. Mostly in this location, but a couple of the manuscripts, as you saw in the ESV footnote, is elsewhere in John, or on one manuscript, this event occurs in Luke, not in John. Okay? So that speaks loudly. Is this really part of John the Apostle's writing of the Gospel? Probably not. We can't say for sure, but probably not. Now, this occurs in a handful of spots in the Bible where there's question, like the end of Mark happens there as well, right? If you think about that, you'll see footnotes there. It's not known if that is part of the original Gospel of Mark or not. And a lot of that is because of the early manuscript testimony. It's generally considered that the earliest manuscripts would be the most accurate because they'd be closest to the author. Another issue with this event is that it's not mentioned or commented on by any of the early church fathers until St. Augustine in the 4th century. So Origen and Irenaeus and a whole bunch of the early church fathers that we have writings from them from the 2nd and 3rd century, none of them mention this event. Again, that speaks loudly as well. Is this really authentic part of the Gospel of John? Probably not. There's two reasons. There's another couple of internal reasons. One is that this event, it says the scribes and the Pharisees right there. We'll get to this. We'll go through this still. Scribes and the Pharisees. John the Apostle does not use that phrase anywhere in his Gospel. It's only here. In this questionable event, scribes and the Pharisees. So that's another reason, okay?
Because he uses the term the Jews.
He uses the term the Jews. Scribes and Pharisees exist in other Gospels, but not here. So that leads some question about this as well. I have another reason that I would question the authenticity of this as part of the writings of John. Now, Dr. Weinrich puts forth, and I don't think it's just him, there's other scholars that would say this as well, that this may still be an authentic event that Jesus was involved in. And what may have happened is that this event, it's very well known, it's very poignant. You can, as we go through it, you'll remember it, or you'll have heard it. This may be an authentic event that was carried on in the early church through oral tradition. Now, you know, back then their memories were much better, and they were much more diligent about parents teaching grandchildren the family lore, right? Oh, great-grandfather, he moved from Idaho to Montana, and he became a gold miner. And so then you tell that story for the rest of the family history, right, or whatever. They had very good memories, and they were very diligent about teaching family lore. So oral tradition was a thing, and it was dependable back then. So could this have been an actual event that took place in the life of Jesus that was preserved through oral tradition but did not get recorded in any of the four Gospels? And somewhere along the 4th century, a scribe who was making yet another copy of the New Testament on another piece of parchment and recording it, very expensive to make copies, everything was by hand, of course, and he said, you know, we've got this oral tradition, we got to record this before it gets lost somewhere around the 4th century. So then a scribe stuck it in one of the manuscripts, and another scribe stuck it in a different spot in a different manuscript, and so there we have some confusion that this is not original to the gospel writers, but it may actually be based on an actual event of Jesus. After reading the article from Dr. Weinrich, I'm convinced that that is likely the case, but I don't know for sure. Okay? Does that make sense? So that's kind of my position now as a pastor, but I'm not going to stake my reputation on it. Could this have actually been written by John the Apostle? Yes, but it seems highly unlikely. Could this be a fictional account of something that took place in Jesus' life? Yes, but it seems pretty realistic, like this is an authentic story, but maybe carried on through oral tradition until the 4th century. Well, there's a hand back there. Ellen?
I think you're probably right, because people must have had a fantastic memory, because I just was reading in Numbers about all these laws and rules and Leviticus and Numbers, all the minute detail of how God told them that you had to do this just a certain way, at a certain time, and with a certain animal, and all these different things. You know, and they had to remember that. There was no one to write it down.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, they did have superb memories. Not like me forgetting the names of my kids. Some of you, too. I think I might have been called Pastor Q once or twice. Maybe he's been called Pastor Measle. I don't know. Yeah, Janet?
Do you suppose that's because they a longer lifespan, do you think?
Well, maybe that's part of it. Honestly, I think part of it is you don't have the distraction of electronics and TVs and media and all of that. So that's not shortening our attention span and distracting our minds. And secondly, I think out of necessity, they had to memorize and learn things from parents and grandparents. And so when you're forced to memorize stuff, you get better at memorizing stuff. I actually tell the kids, I've had a couple of the teachers say, Pastor Measle, can you give them your little speech about doing memory work in school again? And I say, sure. Because I tell them, yes, we're Lutherans, we make you memorize the catechism. Oh, do we have to? Yes. Because not only is it good to learn it, but it also exercises your brain and makes you more likely to memorize other things. So the teachers in the other subjects appreciate that you're doing memory work here, because then you're more likely to remember other things too. It exercises your brain. So I give them my little speech. Most of the 7th and 8th graders don't buy it. But I do think it's true. The more you exercise your memory, the better you get at it. So I think that was part of the reality back then, too. So they had to memorize things, so they became better at it.
Also, what you memorize as a child, I think, you don't forget.
Yeah, you retain it better.
It stays with you.
Okay. So, now knowing that this is, at least in some scholarly opinions, not authentic to the Gospel of John, but very likely based on a real event in the life of Jesus. Okay? That being said, let's go through this. Because it does have some teaching for us. By the way, another quick thought, because I mentioned it last night as well. The handful of places in the Bible where there's a dispute among scholars, is this authentic to the original biblical writings or not? Here, the end of Mark, there's a few other spots as well. You could take them all out of the Bible, and it would not affect a single thing that we believe and teach. Okay? This event here that we're about to go over, it adds an extra detail to the life of Jesus, but if this were missing, it wouldn't affect our doctrine, our teaching, what we believe at all. Okay? So all the disputed sections, there's only a few of them, really are irrelevant to the greater purpose of the Bible. Alright, so, verse 1 and 2 I just read, Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. Verse 3, the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst, they said to him, Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. So what do you say? What say you? They're saying, asking. Well, you know what they're doing. They're setting a trap for Jesus. He has become known as compassionate with the crowds. Does he heal anybody who asks him? Absolutely. Everyone who comes to him needing help, he heals them, he helps them. He's been shown to be compassionate. And yet, in the law of Moses, it does say that she should be stoned. So, if Jesus says, yes, stone her, then he's going to look uncompassionate, hard-hearted, and he's going to lose his reputation in front of the people. If he says, no, don't stone her, well, then he's disobeying the law of Moses. So they're purposely putting him in a hard spot here to try and trap him.
Try to test him.
And it even says that here in the text. Verse 6, this they said to test him that they might have some charge to bring against him. Okay? Now, first of all, the law of Moses actually says that both the man and the woman who are engaged in adultery need to be stoned. So where's the man? Where's the man that's involved in this? Why do they only bring the woman? Well, we don't know for sure, but I will give you my supposition to try and heighten the sense of compassion. It's more likely for the crowds to have compassion upon a woman than upon a man. After all, men, they're scoundrels anyway. They're always looking for a little extra, you know. Right? So who's going to have compassion on a man? Yeah, stone him. Stone them. But the crowds, for the woman, they're going to be more compassionate. So I think, that's just Pastor Measles' speculation, that's why they only bring the woman. Because the man should have been there too, charged with adultery as well. It takes two to commit adultery, right?
I was just going to ask you that.
Yeah.
What about if she's doing that, he is doing that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they're both sinful and at fault. Yeah, both the man and the woman. Right. Takes two to tango, as they say.
Yeah.
All right. Verse 6. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them. So first of all, what's he writing?
I don't know.
Nobody knows. Now, there is speculation. Again, Dr. Weinrich in his commentary, he says, it was quite common for a judge, somebody who was asked to judge legal matters in Jewish culture, for a judge to first write down the verdict and then pronounce it out loud. That way it couldn't be misunderstood. Nope, see, this is what I wrote. You didn't hear me correctly. What I said is blah, 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 and here it is written down. Okay? We still kind of do that today, right? Any judge's verdict in a court of law is always written down. So that there's no mistaking. There's those court stenographers who are typing every, how can they type so fast? And then they're just going like crazy. I don't know how they can type that fast. But anyway. So it's all written down. So, was Jesus writing down what he was about to say? Perhaps. We don't know. Or, the other possibility that Dr. Weinrich in his commentary mentions is that Jesus was just stalling. Because he didn't want to give an answer. He's trying to wait to see if they just kind of melt away or disappear. Because it says right after that, they continued to ask him. So he's kind of sort of ignoring them initially to see what the response is going to be. He tries to ignore them and they continued to ask him. Now, I want to pause right here for a field trip. Is that okay?
Sure.
I want to show you some pictures of the Temple Mount. Because this is another, I'm going to make a point with some of these pictures of yet another very small reason why I personally think this is not authentic to the Gospel of John. All right? So let me pull up some pictures here. Just give me a second. I know I've got them here, so I just got to find them. Oh, is it under the J drive? Pastor Measle. Israel 2. Okay, so first of all, here's a picture of the Western Wall. Can you guys see that in the back? It's often referred to as the Wailing Wall, but that's a misnomer. It's the Western Wall. This is the only authentic part of the temple that dates all the way back to King Herod. It's from this point down. That's original stone foundation. That's why the Orthodox Jews so revere this spot, because it's part of the original temple. And so, yes, they go there, and they're not really literally wailing, but you see the Orthodox Jews, and they are doing their bowing, and they're praying, and then they'll write their prayers on their papers and stick it in the cracks. And so it's the Western Wall, technically, but it's commonly referred to as the Wailing Wall. And yes, you know who that is right there. You're wearing a different jacket, Denny. That's Denny in my picture, so right there. It's good. It's good for scale. See, yes. You see the scale.
Yeah.
So then up on top of this, we were able to go up on top. Let me show you a few pictures up there. So here's a picture of one of the mosques up on top. There are two mosques up there right now. This one is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the one on the southern end. Notice the ground. It's all stone. Now, I don't know anywhere in the Bible that it says that the temple courts were stone or dirt. However, this Temple Mount structure dates back to the Middle Ages when the Muslims controlled the Temple Mount. The Jews had all been driven out, the Christians were all gone, the Crusades were happening to try and regain some control. The Muslims controlled the whole area. And so, would the Temple Mount have had a stone floor courtyards back at the time of Jesus? We don't know for sure, but personally, I think yes. What was Jesus doing in that event that we were just reading? Writing on the ground with his finger. Well, that would require that you're standing on
dirt.
Well, there's a very likely chance it was not dirt. So, that's just my little tidbit to say, I also agree or think that that account in John is not original to the Gospel of John. It's maybe some other event in the life of Jesus.
Is that floor level?
Yeah, it's level.
In the picture, it looks like it's
level. Yeah, it's kind of warped. It's a wide angle picture. Yeah. Yes, it's level. Yes, it's level. Just show you a few more just for a little bit of information. So you look in the opposite direction. There is the Dome of the Rock. That's the other mosque that's on the Temple Mount. And see, surprisingly, I think it surprises some people, there are little patches of grass and trees up there on the Temple Mount. That would not have been there at the time of Jesus. It would have just been an open courtyard with no grass and no trees. Okay, so that's a later addition, that those were allowed to grow, probably from the time of the Muslims in the Middle Ages and beyond. That other mosque there, the Dome of the Rock, by the way, inside of it, which it's extremely hard to get inside because the Muslims protect it so vigorously, inside there is a rock that comes up out of the ground. That rock was in the middle of the temple that Herod built, because it is the rock that the Jews thought Abraham was about to sacrifice Isaac on. It's called Mount Moriah. It was a high point in and around Jerusalem. And it's actually cited as a reason that Solomon built the first temple in this location, because he built it on the place where Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac. The temple was destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans. Sometime after that, the Muslims took control of the entire area for centuries. And according to the Muslims, that same rock is the rock from which Muhammad was taken up into heaven, ascended into heaven, their prophet Muhammad. So they built a mosque on it in the Middle Ages to commemorate it. Well, of course, that totally cheeses off the Jews. And so when you're up here, there is this tension between the Jews and the Muslims. The Muslims control the Temple Mount, but the Jews control everything around it. So there's this constant tension. Us as Christians, we're kind of ignored. Because, you know, we don't think that this is a spot to be revered. It's just a historical place that, you know, back in time, Jesus probably walked here. You know, and so it's kind of memorable and historical, but they kind of ignore us. So that's good. We can walk around somewhat freely. I didn't have any sense of danger up there. I don't know that any of you guys did either. We've got, what, 5 of you here from our trip. And I know, Joan, you were on a previous trip. So, yeah, I mean, we felt relatively safe, I think. Let me show you one more picture of the Temple Mount, and then we'll be done with our field trip. So there's another picture, looking at the other mosque again. And see, there's just people. We're walking around. There's little patches of grass and trees and... You know, it's kind of interesting to be up there on the Temple Mount, where there's a lot of history there. And it goes back millennia. So, yeah, it's pretty profound. And I think this light fixture here is a modern-day addition to the temple. Yeah, that wasn't there back then. Yeah. Right. All right, any questions about that? Let me go back to our text and we'll continue on. Okay, so just a real minor, probably unimportant point, but I think, you know, the temple probably had stone pavement in the courtyards. So where is Jesus writing? So, you know, just lends a little bit more question to this event being part of the Gospel of John.
In the dust.
In the dust, yeah, that would have had to be it, really. So, as they continued to ask Jesus, verse 7 here, he stood up and said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." Oh my goodness. What a wise thing to say.
Yes.
They're trying to trap Jesus, put him in a spot. Do we stone her or not? And Jesus says, "Well, he who is without sin cast the first stone." Basically, a judge should not be engaged in the crime or the activity or the sin for which he is passing judgment. Jesus says that elsewhere as well. Sermon on the Mount. He says, "You hypocrites, first take the plank out of your own eye before you take the speck out of the other person's eye," right? He's basically saying, you have no right to judge another person for a sin which you yourself are committing in spades, you know, to an extreme. If you're committing this sin, you can't judge them for the same sin. That's what Jesus is saying there in the Sermon on the Mount. He's saying the same kind of thing here. Let he who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. You guys want to judge her according to the law of Moses? Are any of you without sin? You want to judge her? You need to be pure as well. Now, he's referring this, I would say, in two ways. The broad way, meaning whoever has no sin, they're the only persons who have the authority to judge. Well, is anybody without sin at all? No. Who's the only one without sin?
Jesus.
Jesus. And God the Father. And God the Son. And God the Spirit. Jesus. Jesus is the only one who has a right to judge. He will not judge now, but when will he judge? On the last day, judgment day, right. Jesus is the only one. So, on a broad sense, he's saying, let him who is without sin among you, whoever has no sin, you're the only ones who are allowed to judge. In the narrower sense, he might be referring to this specific sin in this way. In order to accuse a person of a crime or a sin, you had to actually witness the activity. So whoever brought this woman and the man who's missing, whoever accused them of adultery, had to have seen them in the act of adultery. Now, I don't know about women, but I would say this might be true for men. If you see that action taking place, that's going to put inappropriate thoughts in your head. And therefore, according to Jesus, you've just sinned as well. So Jesus, in a lesser sense, in a more narrow sense, is saying, yeah, whoever's accusing this woman of adultery, are you pure and clean in your thoughts as well? Or do you have impure thoughts in your head? After all, you saw this event take place. They had to have seen it, or else they couldn't properly accuse her. So that's, I think, a secondary thing in view here when Jesus says, let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Guard your eyes, St. Paul says elsewhere. Verse 8, and once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. And when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. Why the older ones?
They had more time to accumulate sins.
They understood first, didn't they? I made the point last night, and I think it's generally true, that as you age, you may lose some physical abilities, but you gain wisdom and experience in life. Right?
Yeah.
Boy, those young people, you know, I got three of them in my family right now. They think they know everything. And the funny thing is, you know, you haven't even lived half of my life. How do you think you know life experiences when you haven't even lived but 15 years? But as you get older, you gain more perspective, you gain more experience, you gain more understanding. Okay? I think it is true generally. You know, there may be exceptions here and there. So yes, the older ones realize what's going on and that they are not without sin, and therefore, what Jesus says, they don't have the right to judge. So the older ones leave first, and then the younger ones start to leave as well. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more." What a wonderful way for Jesus to address this. He does not condone the sin. He does not agree to it. In fact, he says, stop doing it. Don't do that anymore. And yet he has compassion on her. So what a perfect mix of having compassion and yet denouncing the sin itself. Okay? What a perfect mix. It reminds me of kind of that cheesy little saying that Christians sometimes use, but it's true. Love the sinner, but hate the sin. Yeah, it's kind of a cheesy saying, but it is true. We should love the person while not condoning the action, whatever sinful action they're engaged in. That applies to us as well. Because we can engage in sinful actions, but Jesus looks at us and still loves us, even though he does not condone or agree with your sinful actions or thoughts. Mary?
Well, this is what God does. God hates the sin, mm-hmm. but he loves the sin.
Yeah.
And so therefore, we are to do the same, same thing.
Right.
You know?
So I do think it's a cheesy saying, but I think it's a true saying.
It's,
yeah. Now, this whole event started appearing in the 4th century. Well, that's when St. Augustine lived. So he's one of the first church fathers to comment on this. And he says this, at the very end, summarizing it. This is kind of an interesting turn of phrase. He says, at the end, there were left but two, the pitiable woman and pity. with a capital P. Pity. Jesus is pity. Does Jesus have pity on all of us? He has pity on you? Well, I don't want your pity. Yeah, you need Jesus' pity. We all need Jesus' pity. I just think that's a great phrase from St. Augustine about this very event. So there we go. Comments or questions about this? Anne?
So this was not Spirit-inspired?
I would probably say it was not. Yeah. Because it was not written down by one of the gospel writers, John or Luke or any of the rest. It was likely, I kind of am in that camp now, it was likely oral tradition, so based on a real event. But no, not Spirit-inspired. Yeah, that's what I would say. Yeah, Bob?
From reading in the Old Testament and making connections and stuff, does this have any correlation with Jeremiah 17:13, where it says, "The Lord, our hope of Israel, who forsakes you, will be put to shame. Those who turn away from you will be written in the dust because they have forsaken the Lord, the spring of living water."
Huh. Possibly. Never thought about that. That's an interesting connection. I'd have to ponder that a little bit. Thank you, Bob.
Yeah.
Could this be connected to that, written in the dust?
Yes.
Maybe.
Question.
Yeah, possibly. If this is based on a real event that took place in the life of Jesus, even though maybe it wasn't recorded by John the Apostle, could Jesus have been making a connection to that Old Testament prophecy? Yeah. I would say probably. That's a good connection there, Bob. Thank you.
That's Jeremiah.
Jeremiah
17:13.
Jeremiah 17:13. All right. Now, one more little tidbit, one last one before we go on, as to why this whole event may not be or likely is not part of the original gospel. If you take this event out, the Gospel of John actually reads more smoothly. It flows. If you put this event in, where is Jesus? Let me go back to chapter 7. Okay, so here he is at the end. Let me scroll all the way down there. So he's on the Temple Mount, teaching and arguing with the Pharisees, and the officers come to arrest him, and they're befuddled. And then we hear about Nicodemus kind of going back and forth with his fellow Sanhedrin. And then, if you have this event in there, well, then they each went to his own house. And it says in verse 8, Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Okay, that was kind of normal. He stayed often at Bethany with Mary and Martha. And then he came back to the temple, and all the people came to him, and so there he's teaching, and then they all leave, and at the end of this event, he's all alone, and then what does verse 12 say? Again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, it's kind of disjointed. Where did the people come from? They all left. Now they're there again.
Right.
If you take this event out, Jesus was on the Temple Mount. He had avoided being arrested by the temple guards. Nicodemus is making a defense of him, and then down here again Jesus spoke to them saying, see, that flows. The event works without this in there. So that's one last reason why this is probably not original to the Gospel of John. Okay, now I want to get through one more paragraph before we quit. Is that okay? I want to stay in sync with last night's class, so I don't know why I'm behind time today. I must have been talking more. I seem to be gaining more and more of the pace of Pastor Cordocus.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. He covers what? About a paragraph per class? Maybe even less?
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So let's get one more paragraph here. I'll kind of zoom a little bit. Again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Back in chapter 7, what was he just talking about? He is the water. Anyone who thirsts, come to me, and living water will come from him. And here he's saying, I am the light of the world. This relates to somewhere in Isaiah, I think it is. Isaiah says of the suffering servant, the coming Messiah, that they will not walk in darkness, that the Messiah will bring light. So Jesus saying, I am the light of the world, he's making a messianic statement here. Further, he's making a statement connecting him to creation. What's the very first thing God created?
Light.
Light. Let there be light. Further, this is yet another one of those places where we have the I am statements. In Greek, this I am is, you remember what it is in Greek?
Yahweh.
Ego I me, which is the Greek translation of Yahweh. That's true. And in Greek, that's redundant, because you could just say ego, which means I am. The I me is a duplication of the be verb, am. So it's like he's saying, I am, am. Now why would you say that in Greek? It's a little bit redundant. The reason you would say that is because he is reflecting the translation of the Greek from the Hebrew word Yahweh. So it's very clear to a native Greek speaker that Jesus is saying, I am the light of the world. I am Yahweh, the light of the world. That's what Jesus is saying here. So this absolutely is a messianic statement. There's a number of places, a lot of places in the Gospel of John where Jesus uses that phrase, I am, and it's lost on us in translation because we think he's just saying, yeah, this is what I am. No, that has a lot of weight there. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. So the Pharisees said to him, you are bearing witness about yourself. Your testimony is not true. Well, again, back to chapter 7, they were debating with him about how does he have authority. How do you have authority to teach? And so he defends himself. And why is it you are performing the law on the Sabbath? And he defends himself. Well, you do circumcisions on the Sabbath. He defends himself. Here, the Pharisees are challenging him yet again. Now, what are the Pharisees? What are they known as? Teachers of the law. God's law. So generally, that's a good thing. They were teachers of God's law. Should we know about God's law? Yes.
Yes.
But they could properly be referred to as lawyers. So this reminds me again of the little family event, all of you have experienced this, where kids become little lawyers in what you tell them to do. You know, empty the dishwasher, or, you know, make sure you empty the silverware out of the dishwasher. So they empty the silverware out of the dishwasher, but leave the rest. Well, I did what you told me. I said, well, you know, obviously I meant the whole thing, and then clear the table and load the dishwasher. I meant all of that. Well, that's not what you said. You know kids are like that, right?
Yes.
Apparently Jill says I'm like that too. That can't be true, can it? Are husbands like that? You know, she says to do something, and I do what she says, and then she says, why didn't you finish it? Well, I did what you told me. Well, you're just being a little lawyer like the kids, she'll say. Well, I don't know. That's a little bit of a dispute, I suppose. I think many of you have experienced that, I guess. So, the Pharisees are nitpicking with Jesus right here. They're nitpicking the law. Because they've lost the argument that Jesus says, you know, he is the living water and he is the light. They can't debate with him on that. They're mad at him for that, but they can't debate. So they say, you are bearing witness about yourself. Therefore, your testimony is not true. And it actually does say in the law of Moses that if you are trying to determine the truth of something, whether in front of a judge or in front of your family or whatever, you cannot bear witness about yourself, either in your favor or against you, one way or another. You cannot bear witness about yourself. You need to have two other witnesses to establish the truth. Two witnesses be outside of you. Okay, that's what the law of Moses says. Now that's probably a wise thing back at that time, because it's so easy for somebody to lie in their favor, right? So you can't accept somebody's testimony on their own behalf, according to Moses. So that's what they're saying. You're bearing witness about yourself. That's not true. You can't do that. So they're being little lawyers here. All right? Jesus answered. So he's getting a little lawyerly with them in response. Even if I do bear witness about myself, I'm not saying I am, but even if I do, that's what Jesus is saying there, my testimony is true, for I know where I came from and where I am going, but you do not know where I come from or where I am going. So Jesus is saying his testimony is true because of two things. Where I came from, his origin, his identity, and where he is going, his purpose, his goal. Because of his origin and his purpose, his testimony is true. Now I have a little illustration that I thought of. I wrote down in my notes to try and explain this a little bit. If I go over to France, and I try to negotiate a peace treaty or some sort of treaty with France, and I say, okay, here's what I want you to do, this is what the U.S. wants. We're gonna do this. And France says, you're not legitimate authority. We're not gonna negotiate with you or talk to you about any of these matters. I don't have the origin or the purpose to do that. However, if the U.S. government sends an ambassador to France, that ambassador has an origin that comes from the authority of the U.S. government, and that ambassador is sent with the specific purpose of working out a treaty for something. If that ambassador were to pursue something else, that's not part of his purpose, so he would not have authority for that. So see, the origin of the ambassador and the purpose of the ambassador give that ambassador authority on behalf of the U.S. government to work with another government. Does that make sense? That's how modern life works in our complex world, right? That's what's going on with here. Jesus is saying, I know where I come from. I know my origin. I come from God. He has said elsewhere, and he's going to say it again. I come from God, so I have the authority of God the Father. And I have a purpose. My purpose is to save all of you, to forgive your sins, to earn redemption for you. So because of his origin and his purpose, he does have authority, and his witness is true. That's what he's saying. Follow me? Mm-hmm. It's a very deep argument Jesus is making here. And then he says in verse 15, you judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. What does that mean to judge according to the flesh? According to what you see. You're trying to judge based on what's right there in front of you. Jesus is at a higher plane. He's looking at things from a spiritual sense, not just simply what he sees right in front of you. You judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. That's true. Also in the Gospel of John, back in John chapter 3, what did Jesus tell Nicodemus? The Son of Man did not come into the world to
condemn
the world, but that the world might be saved through him. Now Jesus will eventually come to judge. When?
Judgment Day.
Judgment Day, the last day. Yeah. But until then, his work is to save as many people as possible. To have the Holy Spirit spread the gospel message. I judge no one. Yet even if I do judge, see there's a reference to the coming judgment day. Even if I do judge, when I come to judge, my judgment is true. For it is not I alone who judge, but I and the Father who sent me. So there again, he's saying he comes from the Father. Now, by Father, who does he mean?
God.
God the Father. Again, the Pharisees, thinking in earthly things, with their eyeballs, just what's right in front of them, they challenge him on that. Yeah. Right down here. Oh, we're not quite there yet. Verse 17, in your law it is written that the testimony of two people is true. I am the one who bears witness about myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness about me. So there again, he's mentioning the Father, and by that he means God the Father. Well, the Pharisees, being little lawyers, like little children, well, then where's your father? They're thinking in earthly terms. They said to him, therefore, where's your father? Who are they thinking of?
Joseph.
And they know, and we know, Joseph has already passed away by this time. Sometime in the interim, because Joseph's not in anywhere in the Gospels. We know he's passed away before the Passion of Jesus. Where's your father? We happen to know he's dead. Well, that's not what Jesus is talking about. See, they're thinking on an earthly plane. Jesus is speaking on a spiritual plane. Jesus answered, you know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. Because the Father's words, i.e. the Old Testament, all point to Jesus. And Jesus is fulfilling and validating all of God's Word in the Old Testament. They're connected. So if you properly knew the words of God the Father, you would know me. Because all those prophecies point to me. That's what Jesus is saying. And then to finish this paragraph, these words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple. But no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. There's that phrase again. John uses that phrase over and over again. See, again, there's some internal evidence about the style of the Apostle John. He spoke these words in the treasury. Where is the treasury? The treasury were the alms boxes where they would take donations for the poor, and they were included in the court of women. So if you think about the temple courts, there is the court of Gentiles. Gentiles could come this far, but no farther. Then there was the court of women. That's where women could come and hear God's word. And that's where most of the teaching took place. Rabbis would be there in the court of women, because then both men and women were there. And then inside of that was the court of men, where the priests would offer the sacrifices. And generally that would be the head of household would go in there to offer the sacrifice on behalf of the family. So that was the innermost court, okay, before you got to the temple proper. The treasury was in the court of women. That's where they would take donations and alms for the poor. So that's where Jesus is, which totally makes sense, because that's where most of the teaching would take place. He taught in the temple. But no one arrested him. Here it is again. Just like when Jesus was on the precipice in Nazareth, he just walked out from them and no one arrested him. Why? He knew it wasn't his hour, and he knew they weren't bold enough to actually act on their desire to arrest him and kill him. So he just, you know, sometimes you're just bold and you go in the back room of Meyer and get what you want. Right?
Exactly.
You just do what you need to do, and Jesus is bold, and they don't stop him. Yeah. I've never done that, but I might try that sometime, Bob. Maybe while you're on shift. I'll just say, oh, you know what, you're out of chocolate milk. I'm just going to go back there and help myself. And then Bob will see me and he'll say, oh yeah, you have authority, Pastor.
Yeah, you have all authority.
Oh, that's it. Alright, anyway. So, that's the end of my notes. That's the end of this paragraph. Any questions?
Why did he get quiet?
Yeah, I got quiet, that's right. Yeah, Barb?
There's many, many other stories like that.
Oh, yes.
I mean, we just see a little snapshot.
Yes, totally. When we get to heaven, you can ask Jesus, tell us some of the other stories of events in your life. And actually, in this gospel, near the end, John the Apostle says, these things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, that by believing you may have life in his name. And would all the things written about Jesus be recorded, it would fill all the books of the world. So, John admits in his own gospel near the end that this is just a snippet of the events of Jesus' life. Yes, there are lots of other events we don't know about because they never got recorded.
Once you make it to heaven, who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you're there.
That's right. Once you get to heaven, you won't care. But this might be, these first 11 verses in chapter 8, it might be that those are one of those other events in the life of Jesus that we don't otherwise know about. And it just got recorded for us almost kind of afterwards, not inspired, not part of the gospel, but just another event in the life of Jesus.
An afterthought. Yeah.
But that event does teach us. It is a, you know, if that was a real event in the life of Jesus, it does show us Jesus' wisdom. So.
I was wondering when we were talking about the woman that and them saying that if you have no sin, then you could judge it.
Right.
But we can't do that in this day on certain things that people do, like the shooting.
Yeah.
Like the stealing, that sort of thing. You don't just forget about it and let them go.
That's true. You don't. So I would say back in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, when he says, first take the plank out of your own eye before you take the speck out of someone else's eye. The church, as a whole, has the right to judge sin in the world. So we would say, as a church body, that, you know, adultery is wrong. Homosexuality is a sin. You know, all these other types of things that are sins. We have the right to say that, that God would want us to promote the truth. That's how I would reflect what Jesus is saying. But individually, we should not judge somebody else if we are openly committing the same sin, or if it's known we're committing the sin. Now, if you're not committing a sin, you're not engaged in adultery, then say, as a grandparent, you can talk to grandkids who are living together without marriage and say that's wrong. And you've never done that, so that's not something that you've been part of. You do have some authority to promote God's truth in that matter, because that's not a sin that you've been part of. But at the same time that you do such things, where you're trying to promote God's truth, I would also be careful to make sure that you make it known or hint at or indicate, I know I'm a sinner in other ways. So if I have grandkids someday, or kids someday, who are living together with outside of marriage, that would not make me happy. And I would say, your mother and I never did that. You should not be doing that. That's not pleasing to God. Now, I'm sinful too. I sin in other ways. But that is a public way you're sinning, and I would tell you not to do that to be pleasing to God. So I would kind of be firm and gentle with my own kids or grandkids in that manner. Does that make sense? So that'd be my approach. But that, in that way, I would have some authority to say that, because I'm not in that sin myself, although I will admit I'm in many other sins. So we're all sinful. We're all sinful. Luther said, basically, what religion is one beggar telling another beggar where to get free food. We are beggars before God. We tell other beggars before God who have other problems. We have problems. They have other problems. We're telling them where to get free food, the free food being forgiveness. Where do you get forgiveness? Come follow me. I'm a sinner too. Stop doing that. That's a sin. I'm a sinner in other ways. Now follow me and I'll show you where to get forgiveness. Okay, so that's kind of the approach. All right, there you got a little sermonette from me. Other questions, comments? All right. What timing? She got up to leave right when her phone was ringing. It's like she knew it was going to happen. All right. Well, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you for another good quiet.
You're welcome.